So you're there in Proverbs chapter 15, and we are continuing our study through so-called Bible contradictions or Bible contradictions debunked. So this is part three, and really, so I'm going to try to finish up the atheist.org contradictions. So there's 15 contradictions that were on that site, and we've hit some of those already. I'm going to try to finish these up, so I'm going to try to blow through the rest of these, because the other ones I want to get to are the I would call the fun ones, right? Because these are more just doctrinal things they just don't understand. They bring up something, they just don't understand the doctrine, they don't understand what's being said. But the ones that, you probably think of most of the time are dealing with numbers, ages, how many years something was done, stuff like that. And to me, those are more fun because you're dealing with like math, you're dealing with, trying to figure out why they're not understanding it and stuff like that. So next week, Lord willing, we'll be getting into the fun stuff, when it comes to the so-called contradictions. These ones, it's funny because half the time I'm like, that's not a contradiction. You just don't understand like what's being said at all. And, I almost have to look into and be like, what's the contradiction? why is this even on here? So Proverbs 15, verse 28 is what I kind of wanted you to see there. Although Proverbs obviously is awesome in its entirety anyway. But verse 28 there, it says, the heart of the righteous studieth to answer, but the mouth of the wicked poureth out evil things. And the idea with this study is that the reason we're going through this is because it gives you a way to study, to answer, right? So, most of the people that put this list together, you're not going to win those people most likely. But you know what? These questions do come up sometimes, and people will bring up these type of, well, what about this contradiction over here? And this should give you ammunition to say, well, this is what that means, like real quick, and then go into the gospel or something like that. If that were to be the case where they're just holding on to something or they heard something. In a lot of cases, people that are, there's so many contradictions in the Bible, and then you ask them, well, where? Like, how many times have we out soul winning said, hey, they're like, there's so many contradictions in the Bible. I say, can you show me one? They're like, well, I can't show you one off the top of my head, but I know they're there. It's like they don't even know any off the top of their head. They'd have to go Google, contradictions and figure it out. So they're banking the fact that the Bible's wrong, even though they can't even mention one of them, one of the so-called contradictions in the Bible. So that being said, but this should give you a good study on this and be able to answer. Study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. That's what these sermons are meant to do here, is to do some study, to see some certain doctrines and some different ideas that people don't understand. So we kind of already went through a bunch with that list. And to be honest, none of those were hard. just honestly not hard. You can answer these all pretty easily. But I'm kind of taking the time to dissect it a little bit just so that hey, here's exactly why it's a dumb argument or, it falls apart. Now, the next one they had on their list was dealing with incest, okay? Now, what they do is they go to Deuteronomy 27:22, where it says, cursed be he that lieth with his sister, the daughter of his father, or the daughter of his mother. And, they go to Leviticus, which says the same thing. But then they talk about Genesis, where it talks about Abraham married his sister, which was his father's daughter, okay? And I'm going to say this. First off, Abraham is before Moses' law, okay? So you're talking about Leviticus and Deuteronomy, which was given after, after Abraham, okay? So it's not like this commandment was in place and then, he broke that commandment. Second of all, what they're trying to say is like, well, God blessed Abraham even though he married his sister, which was supposedly against the law, which it wasn't at the time, okay? So, but here's the thing. God blesses a lot of people that messed up. You see how this just falls flat on his face just from the surface, right? Their whole point is that God blessed Abraham even though he committed some sin. It's like, well, there's not a just man upon earth that doeth good and sinneth not. So he couldn't bless anybody then if that was the case. So the whole argument falls flat on its face just from the surface. But here's the thing, though. Go to Genesis chapter 20, because that's where they're getting the fact that it's his father's daughter. Because if you remember the story, twice actually, Abraham says that Sarah is his sister, you know, once to Abimelech and then once to Pharaoh. And basically, the whole idea was like he didn't want to die for his wife because apparently she was very good looking. Even at an old age, she was like very good looking, apparently, to the point where he's like, I don't want them to kill me for her. So he's like, I'll just say we're brother and sister. So basically, after he gets caught in that whole thing that, you know, they're actually married, this is what he says in Genesis 20, verse 11. It says, and Abraham said, because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will slay me for my wife's sake. And yet, indeed, she is my sister. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. Now, obviously, when you look at Deuteronomy and Leviticus, if it was his direct sister of his father, so what it's basically saying is that she's my half-sister. Like, that would be the argument, right? But go to Genesis chapter 11, because actually, I don't even believe that she was his direct half-sister. Now, what you have to understand, and I'm going to show this to you, is that in the Bible, sometimes it'll say brother or sister, and it's actually talking about an uncle or an aunt, okay? Case in point would be Jacob and Laban, okay? So, if you remember Isaac, he found a wife of Abraham's brethren, but remember, Abraham sent his servant, and he found Laban, and his sister was Rebekah, right? So he had Laban, and then Rebekah was his sister, and then obviously their father, I forget if it says his name or whatever. But the idea, though, is that Jacob goes back, and then he marries Laban's daughters. But it calls Laban his brother. But it's his uncle. In other places, you'll see this, too, where there's so-called contradictions. And it's talking about Zedekiah, the king. And it talks about Jeconiah being his brother will reign. But then another place, it says his father's brother. So your father's brother can also be called your brother in the Bible. Okay, and you say, well, why do you think that Sarah was not a direct sister? And what I mean by that is that I believe that she was maybe a cousin. Okay, and here's my reasoning. I'm going to show you here. I want you to see, first of all, in verse 31. Genesis 11, verse 31. And Terah, so that's Abraham's father, and Terah took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife. So, Terah calls Sarah his daughter-in-law. Now, Abraham said, she is my father's daughter. Okay? But then the narrator speaking here and saying it's his daughter-in-law. Okay? Now, I don't think Abraham's lying, but here's the thing. That's what Abraham said. That's not the narrator. So Abraham could just be lying. Okay? I don't think he's lying. Here's what I think is going on here. Notice what it says here. Go to verse 24. And you don't really need to know any of this for this to like not be a contradiction. Okay? I'm just making a point that I don't even think he married his half-sister. I think it was a cousin, okay, that was very closely related, probably a first cousin. But notice what it says in verse 24. It says, and Nahor lived 29 years and begat Terah. So Nahor is Terah's father. Terah is Abraham's father. Nahor lived after he begat Terah 119 years and begat sons and daughters. Notice that. So Nahor begat sons and daughters after he begat Terah. Does that make sense? So he begat Terah, then he had sons and daughters. So he had not just sons, but also daughters. Verse 26, and Terah lived 70 years and begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran begat Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. And Abram and Nahor took them wives, and the name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the daughter of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. But Sarai was barren. She had no children. And Terah took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan, and they came unto Haran and dwelt there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Do you notice something that is never said? It never says that Terah had daughters. You see that? Because when you go down this line in Genesis 11, it basically says he begets somebody, then it says, and then he begets sons and daughters. He lived this many years and begets sons and daughters, right? It never says that Terah had any daughters. Now, so two things here. It could be that Abraham just isn't telling the truth, which is possible, right? Because a lot of times in the Bible, people say things that aren't true. But I think what happened here, I think what's going on here is Nahor probably had sons and daughters, and within those sons and daughters, there was someone that was born, that was basically a cousin. Or even Terah had, Abram, Nahor, and Haran, right? And Nahor and Haran may have had children, and the idea of, like, there's cousins that would be like a sister, right? So cousin could be a sister, okay? So I personally believe, and here's the thing. You could say, well, I think it was his daughter. It was the daughter of Terah. And so it was his daughter and daughter-in-law. You could say that, right? I guess. But here's the thing. I'm going to take the narrator over what someone says in the Bible anyway. So if you're going to say, what is concrete proof that Sarah was his daughter-in-law? That's concrete, like no ifs, ands, or buts, right? That Sarah was his daughter-in-law. What we don't know is whether it was his direct half-sister. And furthermore, I think they're both right. I think that he's saying it's my father's daughter, okay? Which could mean it's talking about, basically my father, and father can go back like another generation, right? As far as it could be talking about Nahor's daughter, right? Nahor's, children. Because he lived a long time and had sons and daughters. It could very well have been his actual daughter, right, of Nahor. And obviously, here's the thing with this, though. There was a time when brothers and sisters got married. Okay, go to Genesis chapter 5. Genesis chapter 5. And so, what's going on in Deuteronomy and Leviticus is that at that point, God is saying, okay, I'm putting a limit on how closely related you could be to somebody and marry them. Nowadays, it's even further than that, meaning they're saying, like, you can't marry your first cousin. Okay, and the reason for that, genetically speaking, is the fact that there's a lot of defects that happen when you have like what we would call inbred or and when they say incest here, is not exactly the way we would look at it today anyway. But the thing is that if someone's inbred, like you think of like all the kings in England or something like that. They have a lot of like teeth problems and like they have all these different defects that come down. It's because they're too closely related, okay? And when you're dealing with, and I was just kind of learning about this, dealing with apple trees and stuff like that, and, Pastor Anderson actually preached a sermon on this that was really cool. It was about not being a monoculture type of realm or something like that. And he was talking about apple trees, and he was talking about the fact that you don't just take the seed of the apple and plant another tree because you'll get actually completely different apples. Which kind of sounds crazy, but you get it from the bud of the tree. You go back to the source, okay? Because if you keep going, basically your genes are regressing, right? And each time you have kids, like you're kind of getting these kind of like defects that are going on there. And what you want is you want to kind of spread it out more and go back more to the source. And at the very beginning, you're at the source, right? When you're at Adam and Eve, and then they had kids, you're literally at the source of genetic code. So that makes sense. Like, you don't have to go back very far because you're there, right? You're at the source. It's just that when you start going down through history, you want to start spreading out even more and make sure that you're not anywhere close to any relatives that are really close to you because, the genes are just getting worse and worse and worse, okay? Which is opposite of evolution, by the way. Because evolution teaches everything's like, getting stronger and better. Actually, it's getting worse and worse, and we got to be careful, who you marry because you don't want to get those regressive genes. But in Genesis 5, notice in verse 3 here, it says, "And Adam lived 130 years and begat a son in his own likeness after his image and called his name Seth. And the days of Adam after he had begotten Seth were 800 years and he begat sons and daughters." Now, it doesn't say like who married who after this, but here's the thing. Eve is the mother of all living. Cain and Abel, if you remember that story, right? That was the sons he had before that. And, you know, basically, they had a lot of children. Adam and Eve had a lot of children, and you know what? Those children married each other. And back then, it wasn't, you know, harmful to do. But as time went on, once we got to Moses and the Levitical law and Deuteronomy, that's where God was saying, you need to spread this out more, right? Even to the point where you're not marrying a half-sister or a half-brother. And now we're even down to where we're like, don't marry cousins, okay? Direct, like, first cousins. You know, like, even in, like, a lot of states. I think in West Virginia, it's, like, illegal to marry a first cousin or something like that. And I remember saying this. I'm like, I remember saying this because, you know, we get a bad rap here in West Virginia about, like, inbred and all this other stuff. And I remember saying, you know, we have a law against that. And someone said, yeah, that's because you needed a law. I'm like, touche. Touche, you know. Like, we didn't need a law. You know, like, they're like, he's got a good point. So, you know, you always see these laws and you're like, there had to have been someone to do this, right? For this law to be in. You know, like, don't beat your wife, you know, in this plot at this time or something like that. It's like they obviously had to have some reason to make that law. Or you'll see these little warning labels like, don't drink this. And it's like, you know, toilet cleaner or something like that. And you're like, why would that need to be on there? Like, who's drinking toilet cleaner? Well, someone obviously must have drank it. And they have to put this label on there now or something. So, but anyway, that was kind of just silly, right? Because first of all, you know, off the cuff, just because God blesses someone that does something wrong doesn't mean that, you know, God condones of it, right? So off the cuff, that doesn't make any sense. They're basically saying, well, he blessed Sarah and Abraham even though, like, they broke a commandment, which they didn't, okay? Because that wasn't even a commandment in Abraham's day. So off the cuff, it should just go out of hand. But also, if you look deeper into it, actually, I don't even think he was marrying his half-sister. I think, you know, it was his, the sister, I think it's true that it was the sister of his father. I mean, the daughter of his father, but daughter could be like granddaughter of like Nahor. You know, and that could be why, and they're like cousins. Okay. So, you know, anyway, next one is trusting in God. I think I told Brother Dave about this one because we were, like, obviously on this, like, two-hour trip down, two-hour trip back. And I told him about this one, and he's just like, what's the problem? You know, like, you're reading this, and you're just like, what in the world? Like, why, you know? And I think this goes into the idea that mainstream Christianity is, like, this is the thinking, right? And when people think, well, they would look at what we believe and say, well, the Bible says it's just by faith, but we know it's by works and you got to be a good person. And we're looking at that like, no, it's not. So what's the problem? And because that's what movies tell you and this is what all this stuff tell you. So notice, and so in Proverbs 12, in verse 2, it says, a good man obtained the favor of the Lord. Okay, so you could go there and look at that, Proverbs 12, verse 2. But a man of wicked devices will he condemn. Well, I mean, there's nothing, like, you look at that verse and you see any problem with that, okay? A good man obtained the favor of the Lord. Now, this is what they write, okay? And again, this is on their site. It says, now consider the case of Job. After commissioning Satan to ruin Job financially and to slaughter his shepherds and children to win a petty bet with Satan, God asked Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth? A perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil, and still he holdeth fast his integrity, although thou movest me against him to destroy him without cause. So I guess their argument is that Job was a good man, but he didn't obtain favor of the Lord. That's their argument. It's like, did you not read the last chapter? Go to chapter 42. This is why it's so hilarious, because you're just like, next question? I don't know, like, you obviously are a moron because you never read the last chapter of Job. Like, everybody knows the story of Job. Well, I mean, this phrase, the patience of Job, people say this all the time because they know that his patience paid off, right? The whole point is that Job is a good example of being patient and you'll get your reward in the end. And that's why it's hilarious to me that, like, using Job as an example, he is the epitome of this example of a good man obtaining favor of the Lord. But I think this comes from, like, Joel Osteen, like, your best life now. Like, if you're obtaining favor of the Lord, that means that you won't have any hardships. I think I remember the fact where it says, yea, and all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution, that in me you shall have peace, but in the world you shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. Marvel not, if my brethren, if the world hates you. Know that it hated me before it hated you. I mean, are we reading the same book? Because they're not getting it from the Bible, though. They're getting it from, this is the worldly philosophy. This is what Joel Osteen or Victoria Osteen or Joyce Meyer said. This is what the mainstream says. Therefore, that must be what the Bible says. And they literally picked. And that's what's funny about, you know, people that have false doctrines, or even in the atheist case, they literally picked a case that's probably the best case to disprove their point. Notice what it says in Job 42 and verse 12. So after all the hardships he went through, it says, so the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning. Boom! Next question. Now you can keep reading there. It says, for he had 14,000 sheep and 6,000 camels and 1,000 yoke of oxen and 1,000 she-asses. And he also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. And you know what? Some people may say, well, he had 7 sons and 3 daughters. He didn't double that, did he? Because everything's double. If you look at the very beginning of Job and look here, everything's double of what he had. So he literally got everything double. So tell me again how a good man doesn't obtain favor of the Lord. And they'll say, well, you know, it should have been 14 sons and 6 daughters. How about they're saved and they're in heaven and they're still alive? So he does have 14 sons and 6 daughters. Just half of them are in heaven. So put that in your atheist pipe and smoke it. And the thing is that, you know, I remember being out soul winning and someone said, you know, well, it's kind of questioned whether Job 42 is even a legitimate chapter, and, you know, we don't even know if that was, like, the ending of Job. That's interesting, because James chapter 5 says in verse 10, take my brethren, the prophets who have spoken in the name of the Lord, for an example of suffering affliction and of patience. Behold, we count them happy which endure. Ye have heard of the patience of Job, and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. So, I guess James didn't. I guess James was saying that that last chapter was there too. He's literally the example and the epitome of patience and suffering affliction and obtaining favor of the Lord. And they're like, oh, yeah, this contradiction. You know, it says that a good man obtained the favor of the Lord. What? You know, I know in 2021, I'm pretty much doing that all the time. I'm just like, what am I looking at? And how are people this stupid? Right? How are people this dumb? Am I in the twilight zone? And that one's really dumb. Okay. So again, you remember what these atheists said? They're like, oh, how could anybody read this nonsense? You know, this nonsense and this dribble of, like, the Bible. You know, how could anybody believe that? And this is their arguments. Man, you guys are top tier intelligent right there. I mean, just stupidity. Now, the next one is the holy lifestyle. Okay, so the holy lifestyle, they go to Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 7. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 7. But I'm going to read a little more because what they lack a lot of times is context. And what you have to understand is Ecclesiastes, people, I mean, have you noticed that they've gone to Ecclesiastes a little bit here? Because Ecclesiastes is one of those misquoted books and things that are ripped out of context all the time. And you got to understand that Ecclesiastes, you got to take it as a whole. He's saying from the very beginning of the book that he went to go see folly and vanity and, you know, what's done under the sun. And then at the end of the book, he's stating, this is the whole duty of man, to fear God and keep his commandments. And, you know, if you fear God and keep his commandments, then you'll have a reward and all this stuff for what you do. But he's basically, the whole book is basically stating that everything you do in this life is not going to amount to anything. It's all going to be to someone that it's going to be given to someone after you and all this. But you're kind of like looking at a situation when you're in it, and this is what you're saying about it. It's just as much as when you say the sun goes down, the sun goes up. But we know that the earth rotates and that the sun doesn't move, and that the sun actually isn't going down and up, but it's perspective. Okay? From our perspective, the sun goes up and moves across the sky and comes down. Okay? That's perspective. And it has to do with general relativity. Okay? And you have to understand that when you're going into Ecclesiastes, it's relative to what's the perspective of what's being said. But notice what it says in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 7. It says, "Go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart. For God now accepteth thy works." So their argument is, well, you know, it's saying to eat thy bread, drink thy wine, and be a merry heart. And then another, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 3, it says, "They that rejoice as though they rejoice not." It's like, that's not even a coherent thought, right? You're putting this like in ellipses, you know, like where they put the three dots and three dots. That's not a coherent thought, okay? If I said to you, "They that rejoice as though they rejoice not," you'd be like, what? The whole point he's stating here is he's talking about being married or being single, and he's basically stating the time is coming when those that rejoice are as those that rejoice not, right? It's not saying like right now. It's just saying the time's coming when that's not going to matter, okay? So on the surface, their whole context is gone with what's being said in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. But look at context in Ecclesiastes 9, 7, when you're talking about drinking wine, being in a merry heart, "For God now accepted thy works. Let thy garments be always white, and let thy head lack no ointment. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity." You know what the funny part about Ecclesiastes is that you think he's going one way, and then he zigs another way. Okay? He's like zigzagging. I'll give you an example of this, but let's just keep reading here. "Which he hath given thee under the sun all the days of thy vanity. For that is thy portion in this life, and in thy labor which thou takest under the sun." Right? Does it sound like he's just telling you, like, this is the best thing that you could be doing right here? He's talking about vanity. Vanity. Who thinks vanity is awesome? Who thinks vanity is a good thing that you should be pursuing after, right? But I'll give you an example of how Ecclesiastes does this. Go to Ecclesiastes chapter 11. I love this because every time I read it, I'm like, man, you got me again. You know, like, you're just reading it, and it seems like he's going one way with what he's saying. Notice what it says in verse 9. And this is why you got to get context. And if you were just to read, you know, a portion of this, you'd get the wrong idea. Verse 9, "Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart, and in the sight of thine eyes." Now, if you just put that and put it in an ellipsis and said, see, you know, it's saying you just need to, you know, follow your youth, you know, do all these things, rejoice in that. Notice, keep reading there. "But know thou that for all these things, God will bring thee into judgment." Do you see what God's doing there? He's basically saying, yeah, rejoice in this. Rejoice in your youth. But then it goes on to say that, you know, youth is vanity. And that you need to serve God in your youth. Okay? And not just, you know, live it up in your youth. Okay? But how about this? What they're basically trying to say is that in one place it's saying be merry, and another place it's saying not. Now, that's not even what it says in 1 Corinthians 7, okay, right? But I'll help you, atheist. Let me help you a little bit. There's a verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 talking about, "Let us eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die." Okay, here's a verse where it's saying, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. But that's if in this life we only have hope. But if in this life we only have hope, we are of all men most miserable. Because we're suffering persecution, tribulations, all these different things, we might as well eat, drink, and be merry if there's no resurrection. But here's the thing. Go to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 1. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 1, it says, "To everything there is a season and a time to every person a purpose under the heaven." Go down to verse 4. It says, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. Listen, there's a time to rejoice and there's a time not to rejoice. And so just if God is saying one place you need to rejoice, you need to be merry and be of a merry heart, you know, laughter doeth thee good like a medicine, you know, like, it's not saying to just be this stoic, austere, you know, type of person that you got to live this, you know, this just hard life where you're not laughing, you're not rejoicing. But it's also saying that shouldn't be what your life is about, okay? And how about this in Romans chapter 12, verse 15? Romans chapter 12, verse 15, I think this sums this up perfectly, dealing with the fact that there's a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. How about in Romans chapter 12, verse 15, it says, rejoice with them that do rejoice and weep with them that weep. You know what? You know what the problem is with a lot of people when it comes to these contradictions? They try to simplify things too much. See, they'll say, well, we should love everybody. Well, there's a problem. You simplified it to a point where it's not realistic and it's not actually biblical. And then they say, well, over here it says to hate. I thought we should love everybody. Show me where it says we should love everybody. And let's talk about that. So you see how silly these are? It's basically this passage, they're trying to say, well, over here it's saying to rejoice and be merry, and then over here it says, they don't even give you a coherent thought. They're just saying, like, you know, though they rejoice not. Like, they that rejoice as though they rejoice not. It's like, what? It's not a coherent thought. It doesn't make any sense. But when you look at the context, it's basically stating there's like a time when there's going to be a time where those that rejoice aren't going to rejoice anymore. Okay? And anyway, there's a time for every purpose. So yeah, there's a time to be merry, and there's a time not to be merry. There's a time to weep, and there's a time not to weep. There's a time to mourn, there's a time not to mourn. You know, like all these things are true. It's just the fact that that's life. And the Bible isn't saying to be happy all the time. It isn't saying to be sorrowful all the time. Actually, a lot of times it's saying, rejoice, be joyful in the joy of the Lord. But then it says, let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to heaviness. Why? Because cleanse your hands, ye sinners, and purify your hearts, ye double-minded. Draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. Humble yourselves in the sight of God, and he will lift you up. Because there's a time where if you're in sin and you're double-minded, then you need to get right with God, and it's not a time to be joyful and happy about it. Okay? You need to, you know, get right with God. And that's going to take sorrow, mourning, all that stuff. Now, see how silly these are? Right? We're getting to really just silliness, okay? Now, this one, I'm kind of glad they brought up, because this is one that's brought up a lot, I think. Those other ones, I don't really hear that. I think they just kind of poke at the Bible. Oh, it teaches incest, you know. Even though there's literally commandments against it. It's like, it's not teaching incest, okay? If someone does that, like if you think of Lot and his daughters, do you think God condoned that? Actually, Moab and the Ammonites, the Moabites and the Ammonites weren't exactly blessed by God, okay? Just to put that on the shelf there. So just because that happens, you know, like incest happened in the Bible, doesn't mean that God condoned it. And it doesn't make Lot some reprobate either. It's just the fact that, you know, obviously that was wicked. What happened, and he wasn't even aware of it, all that stuff. But the Bible just records things that happen. Listen, does incest happen today? Does rape happen today? Does sodomy happen today? Yeah, all that stuff happens. Does God condone of it? No. So if God recorded things that happen today of those things that are wicked and said these things happen, that doesn't mean he condones it just as much as he didn't condone it when it was written back then. Now, go to Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20. Now, this one is called, this one's, they say, punishing crime, which is funny because their whole tags are just off, right? But it's talking about, in one place it says that the son's going to bear the iniquity of the father. And another place it says the son's not going to bear the iniquity of his father. So they'll give like Ezekiel 18, where it says the son shall not bear the iniquity of the father. No context. Let's not look at that any further. And then it'll go to Exodus 20 and says, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation. And You know, it basically says, this is their explanation. It says, Exodus 20 is talking about the visiting arms. Actually, there is no explanation. They just put those two verses together. Okay. Well, let's look at context. Exodus 20 is talking about the second commandment, verse 4. So Exodus 20 and verse 4. Exodus 20 and verse 4 says, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Now, the interesting thing about this is that, first of all, you can look at this and say, well, it's not saying that the children didn't hate him, right? Because you could say, well, he's visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children of the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, right? And it's the generations of children that hate him after that. But here's the thing. This is a true statement when you think of, like, let's say you have a nation, right? And a nation just rejects God and just hates God. Well, that's going to affect generations after that as far as the darkness that's there in that country because of that, okay? It's not saying that God is, like, individually, you know, punishing somebody for something they didn't do, okay? Because that's what they're trying to say is that, you know, he's punishing these children because of something they didn't do. It's just the fact that that's the climate that they're in. And the climate is the way it is because of what the father did like four generations ago, up to four generations ago. And you'll see this in countries where there'll be like generations of like kind of darkness, but then there'll be kind of like a revival. And this happens throughout history where like the Mongolians, like they were like Christian at one point, if you didn't know that. And they had like a Christian leader and there was like all kinds of Christians there. But now, what do you see? A bunch of Buddhists, atheists, and Hindus over in those areas. And then you have another, then it goes over, like think about in Jesus' day, right? Where were the Christians at? He had some in Jerusalem, right? But most of them were in Asia Minor and Greece, right? And that's where you had the Byzantine Empire and all that. But then it moved toward like England, right? In England, and I'm kind of skipping things here, but just for sake of simplicity, right? England then became like the lighthouse of the gospel. And then it moved over to America, religious freedom. And then America became that lighthouse. So the idea, though, the sins of England, for example, is still being visited upon them from past generations. In America, you better be careful because your sins are going to cast a shadow upon this nation as well. And that's what it's talking about. Now, when they quote Ezekiel, go to Ezekiel 18:20. Because when you actually read the whole verse, you'll see what the distinction is here. Because in Exodus chapter 20, it's saying he's visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children. He's visiting it, okay? It doesn't say that he's like punishing them, right, necessarily. It's just saying that he's visiting them because of this iniquity. And I do believe that there's like kind of like this curse that's upon them, you know, if you will, because of what the fathers did. And but at the same time, that doesn't mean they can't get saved. It doesn't mean that God doesn't want them to get saved. It's just that that climate has been set up because of what the sins of the fathers did, and that's why it is the way it is. But Ezekiel chapter 18 and verse 20, notice what it says, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. Now what are we talking about? We're talking about capital punishment. You see a difference here? We're talking about someone dying, someone being put to death. Exodus 20 is not talking about putting people to death. It's just talking about the fact that these iniquities are being visited upon these generations afterwards, right? It says, the son shall not bear the iniquity of the father, neither shall the father bear the iniquity of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon him, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon him. What are we talking about? We're talking about whether you die or live. And Exodus 18 is over and over again. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. Ezekiel 33 is the same way. Kind of talking about the same thing. That the soul that sinneth it shall die. And it's basically stating that the son is not going to die for a capital crime that his father did. And you want to see something that just explicitly says that? Go to Deuteronomy 24. Deuteronomy 24 and verse 16. So when it's talking about the iniquities of the fathers being put on the children, we're talking about basically a nation being cursed, or even a family being, you know, like, if you think about it, if your mother and father are a bunch of, like, God-hating atheists, those children are in this kind of, like, dark bubble, if you will, that these, it is affecting them. Would you not say that's affecting the children? And if a nation as a whole rejects God, and the leaders reject God, will that not affect the next generation? And the point he's getting across is that what your generation does will affect the next generation. If it's bad, it'll affect them in a bad way. If it's good, it'll affect them in a good way. And that's what he's dealing with there. And it's more so the fact that, you know what, it's just this snowball effect of, you know, what you choose to do will affect that next generation. So parents, same thing with us. What we do as parents and while we're raising our children, that will affect how they go. Okay. But in Deuteronomy 24 and verse 16, it says, the fathers shall not be put to death for the children, neither shall the children be put to death for the fathers. Every man shall be put to death for his own sin. So what it's stating here is that no son is going to get a capital crime or get capital punishment for what their father did. And same thing the other way around. The father's not going to get a capital punishment of crime for what his son did. Okay? Does that make sense? That's very just bottom shelf. So that's not a contradiction. It's just the fact that you're talking about two different things. You're talking about a capital crime not being put on a son or a father, and then you're talking about the fact that, hey, this father over here, you know, basically commits all this iniquity, and then that carries over to his son. You know, that's what happens. And then that carries over to his next son. And what it's basically saying is that the sins of this one father over here can go on to four generations before it's like kind of cleansed. You kind of see this in the Kings, where there's like this kind of like it's bad, 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 bad. And then it kind of, gets a little better. Then it gets a little better. Then it gets a little better, right? If you think of like Asa and Jehoshaphat, and you go down that, it's like it gets better, 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 better. Then it starts getting worse, worse, worse. Better, 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 best, right? And it's kind of like it doesn't just automatically all come into play at once. It's like Asa was pretty good, but he wasn't as good as Jehoshaphat. Does that make sense? And so just things to think about there, and it's not a contradiction at all. It's just missing complete context. And they do that on purpose. If you think, listen, okay, they are dumb, okay? The fool has said in his heart there is no God, okay? So, but here's the thing. I do believe that they purposely cut out things when they're putting this in there, right? They don't want to give you that whole verse because someone might read this and be like, well, this is talking about being put to death, and this one isn't. So these are two different scenarios, okay? And so they want it to appear as if this is like some stark contradiction. Now, the next one is dealing with temptation. Now, this one is brought up a lot too. This one is one that I've heard a lot of like mainstream atheists use, and it has to do with Abraham being tempted. So go to James. They go to James chapter 1. I want you to go to James chapter 1, and they go to Genesis 22. So Genesis 22 says, and it came to pass after these things, in verse 1, that God did tempt Abraham. And you know the whole story, right? That he tells him to take his son up, to sacrifice his son, and he was putting him on trial, right? It was a trial. He obviously wasn't going to have him kill his son, but he was testing them. And temptation and test are used, like trials, temptations, tests, those things are used a lot of times in, you know, synonymously. But what they'll say is that, well, the Bible says God doesn't tempt anyone. Is that what it says? Does it say it exactly like that? Because they'll go to James 1 and be like, well, he tempted Abraham, but then over here it says he doesn't tempt anyone. Well, let's read that. In James 1, verse 12, it says, blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, see how it's used synonymously? He's trying him. It's a trial, right? When he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. So what's being said here? God cannot be tempted with evil. So when it says he tempted no man, it means with evil, okay? It's not saying that God doesn't tempt anybody. It's stating that God cannot be tempted with evil, but he also doesn't tempt anybody with evil. Like, it goes back to that with evil, okay? Is that it goes, you're basically giving the one side that God doesn't tempt someone with evil, and same thing with man. Or he can't be tempted with evil, and he also isn't tempting anybody else with evil. And notice that, what is it talking about here when it's talking about temptation? Is it talking about God tempting them? Because notice what it says in verse 14. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. And when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. So it's talking about being tempted with lust. Like, your own lust is what causes you to be tempted to do these things. And God doesn't use your lust to tempt you. The context here is talking about being tempted with lust, and then lust causes sin, and sin causes death. And God doesn't tempt people with, like, lustful, sinful things. Okay? That's what the devil does, okay? And so, you got to get context. So every time they do that, you know, they're missing the part that God cannot be tempted with evil. Because they'll use the same logic, or they use the same passage and say, well, this place says that they tempted God, right? Because you'll find another verse where it says they, you know, like, the children of Israel tempted God, or, you know, tempt not the Lord thy God, you know, like, you know, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God, right? That's like something that's said in the Bible. It's like, well, I thought he can't be tempted with evil, okay? And here's the thing. Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, and they'll say, well, that's why he's not God, because God cannot be tempted. Here's the thing, though. You can tempt somebody and not be tempted. Does that make sense? Right? You could be like, let's say you were tempting me with mayonnaise. Because that seems to be the popular thing that everybody loves to talk about right now. Mayonnaise. Let's say you're just like, hey, pastor, I got some mayonnaise right here. You know, I got a whole bottle. You know, whether you want Miracle Whip or just mayo, I got it. Okay? And you're just tempting and waving this thing. Listen, I'm not tempted at that at all. Like, actually, I want to go throw up thinking about it right now. Like, no temptation, right? So, do you understand that? Like, basically, Satan tempted Jesus, but he can't be tempted, meaning, like, he's not tempted by that. Okay? It's not like it was like, oh, I almost sinned, you know? You almost got me, devil, you know? No, he can't be tempted, okay, because he's God. But that doesn't mean people can't try to tempt you. And you could try to tempt me with mayonnaise. You could try to tempt me with beans. But listen, I'm not going to be tempted with that. Be like, I'm on a diet, I can't have any beans. You're like, you want some beans? I made some baked beans for you. I'd be like, no contest. Do that all day long. Actually, you'll make me diet better. I'll probably throw up and lose some weight. Anyway, so for all those that like beans out there, I'm not against you, but I am just not a bean eater. Anyway, you get the point, though, okay? You can be tempted. Like, someone can tempt you and be trying to tempt you and not actually be tempted to do it, okay? And that's where you get into where they're saying, well, Jesus isn't God because he was tempted of the devil. It just says the devil tempted him. That doesn't mean he actually was tempted of the devil, okay? So I hope that makes sense. And, you know, in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 6, it says, wherein ye greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, your in heaviness through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, that it may be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. And so there's trials that are going through. Now, there could be trials where you know, basically like Satan or the world is trying to put you through trials and temptations of lust and all this different stuff. Or you could be dealing with trials that God puts you through. Think of Job, right? Job went through trials that wasn't dealing with lust. It was dealing with God put him through a trial. And Abraham, he put Abraham through a trial. Okay? And that wasn't dealing with lust. Okay? James 1 is talking about lust. It's not talking about like God putting you through a trial. It's talking about like you're dealing with this lust and temptations of the flesh. There's no temptation you taking you, but such as is common to man. That's what we're talking about in James 1. And they try to put these two together and say, well, when God puts you through a trial, that's the same as you being put through trial of the flesh, right? Of sin and lust. You see how you can't just put those two together? Just because it has the same word in there, doesn't mean they're talking about the same thing. So that one falls flat on its face. Family relations. Okay, I didn't name these. This is what they said. Go to Luke chapter 14, verse 26. I've actually answered this verse before. I've also heard mainstream atheists use this argument too. You know, obviously the Bible says, honor thy father and thy mother. We're supposed to love our parents. We're supposed to honor our parents. There's big consequences for not loving your parents and all that. But in Luke chapter 14, verse 26, notice what it says. It says, if any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. So what is this talking about? Well, go to Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10, because there's a very similar passage that's said here. So we're supposed to hate our wives. We're supposed to hate our children. Again, you have to understand that there's you can't oversimplify everything and say everybody gets the same treatment. Like every single person on this earth, you should love everybody. It's just not true. It's not what the Bible teaches. The Bible actually says, shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord? Therefore, wrath is upon thee from before the Lord. And do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? It says, I hate them with perfect hatred. So, and by the way, perfect means complete. That means I completely hate them. That means there's no love. Right? That's like God saying, there I hated them and will love them no more. In Hosea chapter 9, verse 15. Because they're all, you know, it goes into the revolters and all these different things about certain people. So what this comes down to is that there are certain people. Certain people can come to a point where we shouldn't love them anymore, and they could be your spouse. They could be your child. They could be certain people. So this verse could be applicable to you, but it's not necessarily applicable to you. Okay. Notice, and I'll prove that to you because in Matthew chapter 10, we're going to see something similar, but it doesn't say hate. In Matthew 10, verse 34, it says, think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foes shall be they of his own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy than me. Now think about this whole scenario. Is my family, are we all at each other's throats to serve God? No, but it can be. And there's a lot of people where it is. Okay, I mean, you get saved, but no one else in your family is saved, and you're all at each other's throats. But is that for everybody? That's not me. You know, I don't have to worry about this right now because my wife loves the Lord, and we're both following the Lord. So why would I need to, like, even look at this verse and be, like, worried about it? Go to Micah chapter 7, because what I believe is that Matthew 10:37, this is dealing when you have a family member that's either unsaved or saved. Luke 14 is dealing with if you have a family member that is a reprobate. If you have a family member that's a hater of God. Okay? So know that there's a difference between someone that's saved, someone that's just unsaved, like a child of disobedience, a child of wrath. So you have a child of God, right? Saved person. Child of disobedience, child of wrath is just someone that's unsaved that needs to get saved. If they don't get saved, they're going to go to hell. And then you have a child of Belial. You have a child of the devil. And if you have a spouse or a child or, you know, whatever the case may be, that's a child of the devil, the Bible says, if you don't hate that person, then you can't be my disciple. Does it say if you don't hate that person, you can't be saved? Is that what it says? Because what another thing they don't understand is that there's a difference between being a child of God and being a disciple. Okay? Being a disciple is, if you love me, keep my commandments, you'll be my friends. And if you pick up your cross daily, you'll be my disciple. If you love me more than your family, if you hate even certain people in your family, if it calls for it, then you could be my disciple if you do that. But if you don't do that, you're not my disciple. But nowhere does it say, if you don't love father or mother more than me, you cannot be saved. It doesn't say that. And it also doesn't say that even if you don't hate them, you cannot be saved. Look at Micah chapter 7, because Matthew chapter 10 is quoting Micah 7, okay, where it says, a man's foes shall be they of his own household. That comes back to Micah 7, okay? So let's see what Micah 7 is talking about. It says in Micah 7, verse 3, it says, that they may do evil with both hands earnestly. The prince asketh, and the judge asketh for a reward, and the great man, he uttereth his mischievous desire, so they wrap it up. The best of them is as a briar, and the most upright is sharper than a thorn edge. Okay, so when you see thorns and briars, your ears should perk up, because I'm going to show you what that means. He's not talking about, you know, he's likening these people into thorns and briars. It says, the day of thy watchman and thy visitation cometh, now shall be their perplexity. Trust ye not in a friend. Put ye no confidence in a guide. Keep the doors of thy mouth from her that lieth in thy bosom. Do you notice something that's being said? He's saying, don't trust in them. Don't put trust, you know, don't, like, basically, and even the her that lieth in thy bosom. Who do you think he's talking about? He's talking about your wife, right? It says, for the son dishonoreth the father, and the father rises up against her mother, the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the men of his own house. So you're dealing with people that are likened to the thorns and briars, and it says these enemies are the enemies are those that are in your own house. And that's what Jesus is saying. He's like, you know, father against son, mother against daughter. He's basically saying, like, these are family members that would be against you. But ultimately, in Micah, it's talking about children of the devil. Notice what it says in 2 Samuel chapter 23 and verse 6. 2 Samuel chapter 23 and verse 6. 2 Samuel chapter 23 and verse 6. And I'm going to try to blow through this because I want to get through these atheist ones. It says in 2 Samuel 23 and verse 6, it says, but the sons of Belial shall be all of them as thorns thrust away. Now you can read the rest of that, and it's just saying the same thing. The end is to be burned. You know, that which beareth thorns and briars, it says in Hebrews chapter 6, is to be, their end is to be burned, okay? Is rejected, and nigh unto cursing, their end is to be burned, right? And so we're talking about, in Luke chapter 14, what is basically stating here is that if you had a family member that was a thorn or briar or a child of Belial, and you are not willing to hate that family member, you can't be his disciple. Why? Because shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord? Therefore is wrath upon thee from before the Lord. So how are you going to be Jesus' disciple if wrath is upon thee for loving them that hate the Lord? Does that make sense? And it's stating that even if it's a family member. So it's funny to me when people are like, the New Testament never talked about hating anybody. It says talking about hating your wife and hating your child. Okay? But it's not stating that, listen, I don't need to worry about this right now, right? Because all my children are not, none of my children are reprobate. None of my children hate the Lord. So why would I need to, like, does that make sense? And if my family's not against me, do I need to make a choice that, listen, I'm going to love God more than you? Do I need to make that choice? Why would I need to make that choice? Does that make sense? So neither one of these verses even apply to me right now. But listen, if my wife were to say, listen, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that, I need to love God more than her. And I need to make that choice and that distinction that, listen, I'm going to follow God, and you know what? I'm going to please God over you. Same thing, children, you know, if when it comes to, your parents or your parents with your children, you need to serve God over men. You have to obey God rather than men, and we have to love God more than anybody on this earth. And if they're against you and coming after you and at variance with you, you need to love God more than them, even a close family member. And Luke 14 is hitting on a specific group that if you have a family member that hates God, and listen, I bet every single person here has an extended family member at least that hates the Lord. Now, most people that would be saved, you know what they're going to do? Be like, well, I love you. You know, I want to reconcile with you. Is that what the Bible teaches, though? And you know what? That's a strong statement that Jesus makes. I personally love that it's in there. Because, you know, you have Psalm 139 and you have 2 Chronicles 19:2 where it talks about we're not supposed to love those that hate the Lord. But Luke 14 is in there. Okay? And Luke 14 is putting that on the... I don't believe that hate there means love less. And I've heard people say that. They'll say, well, that's just reiterating what Matthew 10 says. And it just means that you love them less. You know, like you hate them, meaning like you just don't love them as much. No, I mean, I believe hate means hate. Okay? I believe a poor means a poor. And in that case, I believe it means hate, but it's talking about if you were to have like a Nabal situation, right? Abigail and Nabal. That Abigail was not to love her husband in that case because he was a child of Belial. And you know what? That's just what I believe the Bible teaches on that. Now, resurrection of the dead. Go to Job chapter 7. Job chapter 7. So there's two more, and I want to just kind of quickly go through these. The last one's just kind of, I don't want to say laughable because there's a lot of people that get confused on it. But resurrection of the dead, basically what they're stating here is that in Job 7 and verse 9, it says, he that goeth down to the grave shall come up no more. And then it'll say in John 5, 28, that, you know, that they which are in the grave shall hear his voice and shall come forth. So it's basically stating that the Bible says there's going to be a resurrection. In Job 7, it's saying, you know, they that go down to the grave shall come up no more. Well, let's look at context. This will answer this very easily. By the way, I don't want to read this for sake of time because we're running out of time. But in Job 19, he talks about the resurrection. Okay, Job 19, he's saying that though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God. So he's clearly saying my Redeemer liveth. You know, I'm going to see him. I'm going to be resurrected. So it's not like Job didn't believe in the resurrection. But look at context. Job 7, verse 7. So they went to Job 7, 9 and just kind of clipped this little portion here. It says, remember that my life is wind. We're talking about this life, his life there. Mine eye shall no more see good. The eye of him that hath seen me shall see me no more. Thine eyes are upon me, and I am not. As the cloud is consumed and vanisheth away, so he that goeth down to the grave shall come up no more. He shall return no more to his house, neither shall his place know him any more. Now, is Job going to return to his house when he raises from the dead later on? We're talking about like his physical life at that time. What is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. Your life on this earth where you are literally walking on the earth and that you could live for God, yeah, that goes away and you're not going to go back to that. Okay? You're not going to come back from the grave and just start living out your life and all that. And here's the thing is that the resurrection is a different type of body. Does that make sense? You say, well, you know, Lazarus was raised from the dead and all these. Yeah, the exception proves the rule. But that's not happening to most people. Okay? Obviously, those are special miracles that happen with certain people that he raised from the dead and all that to be the case. But if you're speaking on a general sense, when you die, and you're in the grave, you're not coming back. Okay? All those people in the cemetery, they're not coming back to like start preaching hard or coming back to do anything, right? And obviously in the resurrection, you're dealing with a different, basically body, and you're not going to be doing the same things that you're going to be doing that you would be doing in this physical body that you're here now. And so they're just completely missing context. The last one on their list was the end of the world. And it had to do with the timing. So this really gets into preterism, okay? And the fact that they're basically stating that the Bible teaches that he already came or he already should have come, okay? So it's not really... It's not really a contradiction as much as that they're just trying to say that it's preterist view or something like that, right? So it's not like they're saying like, basically they're saying that, well, the Bible teaches that he should have already come, right? Sounds a little familiar to 2 Peter where it says, where's the promise of his coming? For since the Father fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation, right? They're scoffers and mockers, right? It's almost like it's just, you know, like self-fulfilling prophecy on yourself, isn't it? Now, what they'll use is Matthew 16:28. Go to Matthew 17. But Matthew 16:28, it says, "Verily I say unto you, there shall be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." So I've seen this many times, and preterists like to use this. Preterist just means someone that believes that basically Jesus already came and all these things have already happened, right? It's about the past. It already happened in the past. And it's false doctrine. It's not true. But they'll use this passage to say, well, there's going to be people standing here that's not going to die until they see this happen. Okay, that's their argument. But they should have read the next verse, which was the next chapter. In verse 1, it says, "And after 6 days," so literally 6 days later, this happens. "Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, and bringeth them up into a high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them, and his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light." You say, well, is this talking about his coming into his kingdom and that they're going to see this? Well, go to 2 Peter chapter 1, and it validates it. And I'm going to say yes, okay? When he says, "You shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom," that happens 6 days later on the Mount of Transfiguration. And you want proof of that? All right, who were the three people that were standing up there? Peter, James, and John, right? So Peter, 2 Peter was written by Peter. Notice what it says in verse 16. "For we have not followed cunningly devised fables when we made known unto you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but were eyewitnesses of his majesty." Do you see that? Peter says we were eyewitnesses of his majesty, talking about the coming of the Lord. "For he received from God the Father honor and glory when there came such a voice to him from the excellent glory, 'This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased,'" which, by the way, was said on the Mount of Transfiguration. If you go back to Matthew 17, if you keep reading that story, that's what is said. God the Father says that out of the cloud, and they're all fearful, obviously, when they hear it. Notice in verse 18, "And the voice which came from heaven we heard when we were with him in the holy mount." So when did this take place? In that Mount of Transfiguration. When they heard this voice that said, "This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased." And they said, "We are eyewitnesses." And that's why he says in Matthew 16, that some of you shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom, and they were eyewitnesses of it. So, yeah, that's what happened. Then the other one, and this was one we probably talked about before, is this generation. Go to Matthew 24. Matthew 24. And then they go on to say, like, oh, you know, it's near, you know, and all that stuff, and it's not really near. And it really comes down to this, is that the Bible says the day, you know, one day is with the Lord is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. So when you're saying the time is at hand, you know, when Revelation says that, that means it could happen, you know, that time of, like, the Antichrist coming in. Yeah, I mean, that could happen at any time. But you know what? 2,000 years later, it still hasn't happened. But to God, 2 days. Right? That'd just be 2 days to God. But the last one I wanted to talk about is this generation. They'll say, well, it was that generation that saw this. In Matthew 24 and verse 32, it says, "Now learn a parable of the fig tree, when his branch is yet tender, and putteth forth leaves, ye know that summer is nigh." Now, the parable of the fig tree, you know what that's talking about? That the stars are going to fall from heaven as a fig tree casteth off her untimely figs when the heaven is rolled away as a scroll and the sun and moon are darkened. That's what we're talking about, okay? So it says in verse 33, "So likewise, when ye see these things, know that it is near, even at the doors." What things? The sun and moon darkened, which is after the tribulation, by the way. And then it says, "Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." What are we talking about? The generation that sees all these things come to pass. Right? If you're talking to somebody and say, "Hey, learn this parable, that when you shall see all these things come to pass," what? The sun, moon darken, and, you know, the stars falling from heaven, which lines up with the fig tree parable, right? When you see these things come to pass, this generation is not going to pass. What generation? The one that sees these. Okay? It's not stating that, well, it has to be that generation that he spoke to at that time. He's just saying, hey, these people right here, okay? This people that see these things come to pass, they're not going to pass away until all these things come to pass. Why? Because we know that Jesus is coming in the clouds. Like, that's the next thing to happen. It's at the doors. at that moment. So you can, you know, when you can say that the day of the Lord is at hand, when you see the sun, moon, and darken, and the stars fall from heaven. When you see that, know this, that you're not going to die until you see him coming in the clouds. Okay? And so it's kind of funny because that's not really a contradiction. That's just them like having some weird predator's view or something like that on that. But that's the atheist.org. You know, obviously none of that panned out for them. But that's why they think the Bible is a joke, you know. And you know, they could come back and be like, wow, there's so many more. Then why didn't you put it on your site? Why didn't you put your biggest ones on the site? If I took out your biggest ones, guess what? The next ones are going to be a joke. All the rest should be easy because those were easy. So, you know what? That's the atheist one. But we'll get into the fun ones later. I think those were fun too. But we'll get into the numbers and the co-regency reigning and, you know, different things like that that I think will be fun to get into. And some of you are like, I don't want to do math. I don't want to think about numbers. I think it'll be fun to go through those. So let's end with a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. Thank you for your word. Thank you for a day that we can celebrate fathers and just pray that you'd help us to be good fathers. And thank you for your word and that everything fits together and that there are no contradictions in the Bible and that we can trust it fully and that we can use it. And Lord, just pray that you'd be with us throughout this week and that we bring glory to your name. In Jesus Christ's name, amen.